Paddington 2 sucks. Do some brain works and listen to the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies nobody else wants to talk about. And this is episode number 104. And my name's Jakub.
And my name's Randy.
And today we are continuing our odyssey through 80s space westerns. And we'll be talking about Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone. I think that's how we should say it. It's a very long title,
but you know. Very, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't even know how we got. I think we just ended up looking exactly. Can we find a few more space westerns to pair it up with Outland? And then that's how. So it's a shot in the dark.
It fits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's another one that I just found on IMDb that we could have done. Ice Pirates.
Oh yeah. Yeah. True.
Leave it in the bank. For
yep.
80s space westerns reloaded. Before we do this, though, as we'll mention on the Patreon, which is patreon.com/uncutgemspod, you can find a few bonus recordings that we have recorded for the month of January, which are High Noon, which is a tie-in to the series that we're doing now, specifically to Outland. Shallow cut of our Steven Soderbergh project that we'll be going through his entire filmography over the course of this year and some, because we did some back of the envelope math and we were just like, we're going to kill ourselves if we try to squeeze it into one whole calendar year. So it's going to be a little bit longer than a year. But we have Sex, Lies, and Videotape there for your listening pleasure. And then next week, if you're listening to this at the day of the release, which I suppose you should, then next week we will be dropping. So by the end of January, I think last Wednesday of January, we'll be dropping the first inaugural episode of our John Cassavetes marathon, where we just recorded this, by the way. So we talked about Shadows, and that was a conversation and a half. So we strongly encourage you to support us by signing up to our Patreon. $3 a month gets you this and everything else that we have in there, which is a full complete David Lynch marathon, more bonus tie-ins, mini retrospectives and whatnot. And also, if you sign up in the month of January, you will also receive a thank you mug, which also, by the way, I should mention, a few shout-outs are in order. So first of all, we just had a brand new patron joining our flock. So that's Sofa Cinema. I think this is someone you know, Randy, is it not?
Yeah. This is a good friend of mine, and actually someone that one day I hope that we manage to nab and have him on the show. He's been sort of a gateway to a number of filmmakers and all kinds of cool discussions for me. So yeah, we're very happy to have him on board. And I know that he's a supporter of the show and has been listening for a while. So shout out, Sofa.
Yeah. So happy listening. Hope you like what you find in there. And also another shout out, which is a little bit delayed because my cousin, Yannick, subscribed to our Patreon just, I think, before Christmas or around Christmas time. But we had everything recorded until the end of the year. So I should have redone this last week on the Outland episode, but somehow kind of just didn't remember that, because this happened just a week and a half before that. So yeah, welcome aboard as well. Hope you enjoy what you find in there, in the treasure trove of madness that we have in our Patreon. So I said, well, this is everything I wanted to plug. So let's just dig into it, shall we? So how about we talk about Space Hunter?
What the hell are you?
What do you think I am, you scrawny earthbag? I'm a woman, an earther. You better not skiz my home or I'll get my father to split your face. And I got brothers too.
That's your father in there. I got news for you. He's been dead for about 10 years.
Oh. Well, this is my place anyway, so bone out.
Whatever you say, princess.
Wait a minute, you got any food? Because if you got food, I can help you. I'm a tracker. I know everything about the Skrodian planet.
Sorry, I'm booked up for the day.
Space Hunter is directed by Lamont Johnson. Mr. Johnson. And it stars Peter Strauss, Molly Ringwald, Ernie Hudson, Michael Ironside, and a bunch of nobodies. In a story about, let's just say, a space salvage operator slash smuggler named Wolf, that's Strauss, who receives a broadcast with a reward for saving three survivors of a ship destroyed by a bolt of, I think, nebular lightning is the phrase. It turns out that the castaways crashed on a hostile desert planet and were taken prisoners by an evil overdog McNab, that's Ironside, and together with a scavenger he picks up, which is Ringwald, and an old friend from the military named Washington, and that's Ernie Hudson. After the reward, they all face off against overdog McNab and try to save the cheerleader and save the day, I suppose. So, just a few little words. I don't have too much on this, but I think this was a studio film, by the way. So that was a Columbia picture that was greenlit in 1982. And it was produced by Ivan Reitman, by the way. Harold Ramis did some voiceover work, if you don't know. Uncredited. So there is a voiceover somewhere that's apparently Harold Ramis. I couldn't pick it out. This was planned as the sort of like to be like a 3D vehicle for the sort of the 3D hysteria, that kind of just the renewed 3D hysteria of the early 80s. It kind of sort of shortly happened in Hollywood. But this was only decided after a director was fired, because it was supposed to be directed by a guy called, I think it's a guy, Jean Lafleur or Jean Lafleur?
Jean Lafleur.
Yeah. So apparently... This guy didn't really pull his weight. Everything was behind schedule. After 2 weeks' time, the producers got rid of him, got Lamont Johnson, and he said, like, what the hell's happening here? Like, the script's horseshit. Molly Ringwald hated her lines, so she thought, can I rewrite my lines? And then Lamont Johnson's like, rewrite everything as far as I'm concerned. So she did rewrite her lines, I think. So they did quite a lot of work on that. And also, by the way, before Lamont Johnson was also brought on board, I think Jeff Bridges was briefly concerned. He was supposed to play the role that went to Peter Strauss. So the film was shot in native 3D, by the way, with two cameras. But apparently they didn't have anywhere to screen it the way it's intended, so that's a bit of a bummer. And as a result of this, because, you know, like, Lamont Johnson essentially just came in and then just rewrote the book, the budget kind of just spiraled into roughly $15 million, and then the film took a total of 16 at the box office, so I think it qualifies as a bomb. Mm-hmm. And I think critical reception didn't help because it was panned. And then on top of it being panned, it's also kind of sort of forgotten, which is why we're here. Because I don't think this film has found... like a life of its own on the home video shelves. I think it's still kind of sort of more or less a curiosity, which is why we're here, to go and find out whether there's something to be championed in here. So how about we start talking about this, and I'll just shut up. Randy, tell me, what do you think?
All right, so this was completely a first time watch. I have no recollections of this from my childhood, and I think that you're 100% that this does not seem to have a cult following, at least not a strong one. It seems to be one that has been forgotten. It's just one of those titles. A week or so ago, I put it on in the background, and I thought, okay, I'll do some other things here, and I'll just have it on in the background because I think I know what to expect, and that's fine. But then when I got around to rewatching it, sort of a proper rewatch a couple days ago, you know what? This is really good. I quite like this, you know? and while last week it was just sort of playing on in the background, it felt like it was just sort of moving to certain beats. When you really settle in and pay attention to it and give it an honest turn, it's good. It's not original. It's clunky as hell, and watching it, it's dated. But yeah, again, it's pretty good, especially considering they had... This is the low-hanging fruit of filmmaking targets in the 80s, in my mind, is we're going to try to rip off Star Wars, Buck Rogers, The Road Warrior, these types of things that are successful on TV and in film, like Star Wars in particular. And there's a lot of Road Warrior in here.
Oh, yeah.
But that's its target. That, and you know what? It does perfectly fine. There's some good set pieces in here. If you dig into it, there's some decent humor that's written into this. I quite like it. If you squint really hard, there's a couple interesting ideas. There's a surprising amount of horniness in here, which I thought was sort of interesting. But, you know, they're just trying to make a Star Wars. And, you know, at the end of the day, everyone in Hollywood wanted to have their Star Wars on their roster of films to be released, on their roster of new coming shows. Everyone wanted that space Western, that space drama. And a lot of them are really clunky and feel really crappy. This one is cliche for sure, but it's honestly decent. What I'm also really interested in this, and we chat about this further, you were alluding to some of it already, is Reitman's involvement. So we talked in December about Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2, and I watched a lot of Reitman films last year. So it's interesting to note that this is Reitman right before Ghostbusters, but he is successful at this time. And one thing I always liked about Reitman is that he stayed in touch with the Canadian filmmaking scene. And that's my sense of what's going on here. Like the screenwriters, a couple of them at least, like Len Bloom is Canadian, if I'm not mistaken. Dan Goldberg's Canadian. That's the guy. So these are two of the guys that co-wrote this screenplay. Dan Goldberg is the guy that Reitman was arrested with
for indecency
laws around the arts. So, you know, so they have a long history together. Exposure. So it's not indecent exposure. They produced the Columbus of Sex, which was a naughty film at McMaster University, and anyway, they were just on as producers and they ended up getting charged. But anyway, but this speaks to me, like, you know, in a way, like that's interesting. Like Reitman, it was a guy, he was like a fixer, or he was an idea guy, and he was the one who came into this or was part of this as producer and said, you know what, this 3D thing, maybe if it catches on, that maybe we should do a space one, because I think before 83, you were just looking at 3D horrors. So like I see Reitman as this sort of innovator and this guy that's blending ideas, and that's sort of here a little bit. So that's sort of interesting to me. But in terms of the watch, yeah, it's simple, but it's fun. I've got very little by way of complaint. What was your thought on it?
For me, it's kind of... I should probably just get some kind of a soundboard so we can have these alerts of, like, you know, like when you drop an F-bomb, which doesn't happen, right? I'm trying to clean up my language too. I don't know if anyone noticed, I'm not swearing anywhere near as much as I used to. This is, you know, so that this is called personal growth, okay?
New year, new us.
I'm going to run out of steam at some point. But, you know, like, for now... Whee! So I'll say this. We picked it out almost out of a bag, right? It was kind of just like, let's do space westerns. Like, let's do Outland, pretty much. That was it, right? And it's just like, we need to find another one or two. Okay, what else can we put on the list? Oh, there's this. Like, it was essentially a result of like going through a Wikipedia page of listing space westerns. I'm not even kidding in here.
Yeah.
So let's just do this, right? So for me, this was a complete shot in the dark. Let's just pick it up and watch it. And I'm watching this. And then for me, the movie opens with this sort of... By the way, the movie opens with the score that's very much like, oh, is this scored by John Williams? No, it's scored by Elmer Bernstein, but it kind of feels very sort of Star Wars-y. It's very epic, very grand, very, you know... Very much Superman meets Star Wars, I want to say, in terms of... Or, like, the main theme of the score is kind of like the throne room theme in Star Wars. The ba-ba-da, ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da. These sort of beats, and it just moves. And then, but then you kind of just land on the ship with Peter Strauss, who kind of sort of, I think, was asked to be Harrison Ford. You can afford Harrison yes. Ford. which apparently this wasn't his bag as well. I think Ernie Hudson has a few things to say about how this movie got made. And he was just, Peter Strauss could not feel very nice trying to be this sort of suave, like rogue. He has a bit of a different demeanor. But anyway, so on the spaceship, you kind of see this guy trying to, I think my note says, he's really operating a computer like an absolute Philistine with a hammer and just say, oh, it's busted, right? And just because like, the way you operate, like, that's why it's busted. But then it kind of feels like a 50s film, but you know, like he presses buttons and go beep, boop, 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 beep. You know, it feels like Charlton Heston in the beginning of Planet of the Apes when they have this sort of like a barber sort of thing going on in the background. And just that machine's doing something. So it, you know, has this sort of little spirally thing going on. So it feels very fake. And then they land on this planet, and I think they land in Utah, as far as I'm concerned. Because it's this sort of like Monument yeah. Valley, this sort of desert sort of landscape. And all of a sudden, the film is kind of just filtered through the sepia filter. And it looks so good. It looks so awesome. And then all of a sudden, this movie just picks up, and then you have a set piece with a pirate ship, and then there are these people shooting blasters, and there's this shit exploding everywhere, and it's just practical, beautiful sort of filmmaking. It's fake, you know, it looks kind of sort of shit, but I think you just touched it perfectly. This is kind of just halfway between The Road Warrior and Star Wars. And I'm watching this, I'm just thinking, that has this sort of like Return of the Jedi sort of vibes in the beginning. And mm-hmm. Fun fact, Return of the Jedi came out after this, exactly 1 week after.
Okay.
Which is probably one reason why this movie doesn't really exist in the popular culture, because it's like, I don't want to say it's like The Sorcerer, you know? It's just like, oh, George Lucas stole its thunder. No, it was never going to be a massive success. But it has the polish and the veneer of a studio production that kind of separates it from like the schlock of something like Battle Beyond the Stars, that you know it's kind of made of styrofoam.
Right.
But it equally kind of feels like it's made of styrofoam. So it's kind of like a,
yeah.
I don't know. It's like an amateur film that someone convinced a bunch of professionals to come and craft. And I really enjoy it. Like, it's such an easy watch, such a brisk watch, and it's funny as well. Molly Ringwald has her moments. Sometimes she kind of just goes into, like, way into Kate Capshaw territory and Temple of Doom when I just want to strangle her. But overall, I really enjoy this film and how the ambition of its sets and the design of things and these, the costumes are great. Mm-hmm. The special effects are amazing. This movie is just, the sum of its parts, just a great B-movie experience. And then just some of my initial question for this is, how does it stack up against sort of like the other sort of representatives of the genre of like the 80s, I suppose, or in general? Because it feels like we both kind of sort of borderline love it. And then, and here's this entire world that's essentially sleeping on it. How is this possible? What does this film not have that other science fiction films of its time do have? Or how would I sell this to someone who, and who do you sell this to, right? I don't know how to phrase it, but it's kind of what I'm interested in, like, initially. It's just like, why? Where's the genre difference that kind of makes this film kind of go like, meh?
Yeah, it's a good way to start the conversation. And I don't necessarily have an easy answer. Like, I can't, like, I was just a child when these came out. So I don't really have a lot of the relevance and context of the day in mind. Like I would with, like, I might have more opinions if it were something released in the 90s. But I know that there was a metric ton of these movies and TV shows that were being produced and released. And I wonder if part of the thinking, and especially because you just mentioned that it was released right before Return of the Jedi, I wonder if it was the type of situation that maybe we can capitalize on all the marketing that is going into Return of the Jedi, because people know Return of the Jedi is coming. Maybe we can make a few incidental bucks because we are the space drama that's in theaters the weeks before or the week before. You know, maybe that's part of it. Like we saw a little bit of that with Deep Star 6 and Leviathan. Like they just made those films on the cheap in a way. And it looks like they did so because they knew that The Abyss was coming, and they've tried to get those productions in on time and released before The Abyss. So I wonder if maybe that's a bit of a piece here, that they thought there might be some money to be made right before. Maybe there's a bit of a spillover expectation that in week two, all the cinemas are going to be filled. So there'll be spillover into Space Hunter after Return of the Jedi sells out. So I wonder if they were sort of banking on a couple good weeks at the box office, and especially with the 3D, maybe they'd have a bit of a gimmick going for them to help draw people in. You know, I'm just sort of wondering here myself, and just theorizing. I don't really have anything concrete or no real reason to think that these would be correct, but it was a market that was pining for this type of thing. As I recall, like Black Hole was successful on TV as a property, because that movie was, you know, in constant rerun every year on TV. Buck Rogers was popular on TV. So there was an appetite for this type of production. So it's just one more, and it was probably released where it was just so that they can capitalize on it. And I wonder if the Reitman angle just allowed these guys in Canada that were working on something similar. I wonder if without Reitman, it doesn't get made. I wonder just because if he was in contact with, you know, some friends and maybe some Canadian investors, because I get this, like it's a Canadian-American production, even though it ends up being distributed by Columbia. I wonder if part of it exists because Reitman's in contact with some people that are working on something like this, and he helps bring it to market. And without him, maybe it goes nowhere, because it is one, it'd be a project sort of on the cusp of, you know, do we make this, do we not?
But so why would you not make this, by the way? Like, sorry to prod you, but you know, like I'm kind of like, I'm gonna interview a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think that maybe this doesn't get made because there are so many. You know, at some point you're going to have some studios and networks that say, well, do we really want to do this? There's so many of them. So I could see, like, and I think, what's the appeal with this project? You don't really have a star. Molly Ringwald is the closest thing you have to a star, but she's not a star yet. Ernie Hudson's not a star yet.
For Molly Ringwald, it was her second role, by the way.
Right.
Ever.
So yeah, like this is... yeah, so she's not a star. No one in
Peter
here is
Strauss
a star.
Was it was supposed to be his big break, right? Because he was coming out of TV.
Yes.
Right.
And yes, you're right. But I forget what it was. And he had, you know, a number of, I think, Emmy nominations.
Something like Gunsmoke or something.
I don't think it's a Western, but it's might be a procedural or. Is it a hospital drama or something? I sort of forget, but he's the name, and it's, but I sort of think that this is a little bit of a risky venture, you know, because you don't have really anyone necessarily attached to it that's going to be a draw. Ivan Reitman is, you know, producing it. I think that's great, but he hasn't made Ghostbusters at this point, for instance. So it's just one of these projects that I think was rushed along and was just called upon because, oh yeah, we should get some more content. And Columbia said, yeah, we can make this work because we don't have anything. I don't know if they had anything or not, but maybe we don't have anything in this space, in this space drama. So let's get something. And they purchase it from Reitman and whomever. I'm totally guessing and spitballing here, but I can see a case for this being made. I can see a case for this not being made. My suspicion is that it was all about content, and Columbia probably saw a bit of an opportunity. If we can release this in the same calendar period as Return of the Jedi, we might get, they might be doing some of the promotion for us. So, you know, if there are full theaters for Return of the Jedi, we'll have some people come, or we'll get some people who are excited about, you know, space operas. We'll get them to come see our thing the week before. And we've got the gimmick of 3D. So that's where I see this. But it doesn't necessarily have like a lore. It's not based on anything. Like as you said,
it's
like
fully it's an original
property. So I think it's just this race to get more space content, and it ended up being picked up maybe by virtue of Ivan Reitman knowing people who are working on it, as opposed to anything else.
Speaking of, I wanted to kind of respond to this, but before I do this, do you think there is like an because you've gone through quite a few Ivan Reitman films recently, do you feel there is an Ivan Reitman sort of connection somewhere in there? As in, like, you can feel that there's the guy's hand is sort of guiding something in there, artistically speaking.
Artistically, not necessarily. Like, maybe just in terms of blending ideas. Like, I see Ivan Reitman as a very interesting businessman and producer. So I see him seeing a project, and he might be the guy that says, oh, you know what, there's plenty of room in the marketplace for, you know, another space drama that opens up before the next Star Wars film. So if we can get one out like before that, people will eat that up because the marketing's already being done for Star Wars. Let's add this gimmick. We've got, I think it was Amityville 3D. I think that was the thing at the time. And
Jaws 3D, Friday the 13th.
So these all preceded, and he's like, we should do this in space. There's some bucks in there. So I think that's sort of Reitman's genius, is he blends these ideas like of Arnold and comedy, or, you know, Saturday Night Live chemistry comedy and sci-fi. Like he's just got this sensibility about him that, yeah, like that's a really good idea. People will really go for that. And I think that's what he's maybe contributing here a little bit. I can see it. And, you know, this is before Ghostbusters as well. So it's just another project that he has some sway in. That would be my opinion on that.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, because this is sort of like the main sort of, the main tenet of what you were saying was basically, let's capitalize on Return of the Jedi coming up. And then the fact that there is a market saturation with these kinds of stories, so they might as well just do some marketing for us. And for me, this is something, like, I hate to just get on the soapbox right there and then, but I think I might as well have to, because this is what cultural footprint looks like, dear James Cameron, right? kind of feel like, you know, Star Wars was such a massive game changer for the market and for the studio system that everyone wanted in on the action. And then when I can't remember, like, so a bunch of people wrote about this I think over the last couple of years, and I've written about this myself on my little website, and it's not like I don't know, my take's so original or anything, but just I read all these other takes after I wrote mine, because I just tried to kind of be fresh, that, you know, people kept moaning about the fact that there isn't much of a cultural footprint to something like Avatar, the biggest film of all time, that made $2.5 billion, left absolutely zero cultural footprint, right? And then it should have eclipsed that of Star Wars based on how much money it made and how many people came out to see it, right? And now it looks like the narrative is being written around, well, maybe there isn't, like, you joke about this, joke about that, he gets people out of beds to go to the cinema once a decade, so what? And but it kind of looks like no one really wants to follow in his footsteps and then say, there's no Me Too movement of, like, well, not Me Too movement. There's no this of Me Too cinema of let's do a little bit of that ourselves. No one wants that.
Like, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I think you might be onto something, because they tried that with underwater thrillers.
But that was ahead of Abyss coming out, right?
Right.
But then, see, Alien was a game changer. This was... The underwater thrillers are essentially Alien underwater, but they don't come back to James Cameron much as much as they come back to Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott was a trendsetter in there, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
yeah. So again, like the Terminator actually fit in the sort of the cultural footprint left after Halloween, as far as I'm concerned, because that's essentially Halloween with a guy coming out of the future. Michael Myers from the future, right? But then I feel like this is the Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, as much as it, no one really remembers it, is a part of the sort of the long tail of schlock that came out of the fact that Star Wars made a difference, right?
I think that's right. And what James Cameron does in terms of influencing other films, maybe I shouldn't say it that way, but in the same way that we're comparing maybe to Star Wars or to Alien, people are not trying to recreate Avatars in the same way. It's just such a unique thing, and it's so involved. And I think that's where I was going with the underwater thrillers. Like, Cameron's doing such a unique thing in a way. It's just for him. People will go out and see it probably, but no one else wants to go out and do it. And everyone's fine with it as a one-off.
I mean, for me, his foot. I mean, this is me derailing my own conversation, right? The cultural footprint left after Avatar, the first one was at least that it kind of reinvigorated 3D for a little while. That was so the only footprint it left was technological. Right, so I would give him that, but then again, equally speaking, he like Avatar, and Avatar 2 is already disappearing from the conversation. It's no one cares, no one gives a shit. It's probably gonna make $2 billion tomorrow, and no one cares really. Like, it means nothing. It's essentially just it's like a cultural footprint left at we don't discuss how much a roller coaster changed culture. It didn't. You know, they built this big one with a big loop somewhere in San Diego. No one gives a shit, apart from people who are really into roller coasters. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it's merchandising? Do you think it's target market? You know, because this isn't marketed to, like, I know inevitably there'll be some 12-year-olds that go see Avatar, but it's not a marketable property for merchandise. Like, you're not going to have kids with Avatar, like 4-year-olds with Avatar on their underwear and lunchbox Avatar lunchboxes. Merchandising.
I think it is. If it was my money as a studio producer, I would say, yeah, flood the market. Everything's blue. Blue hoodies, blue everything. Make it blue, you know? Because it's just a simple blue papyrus font, whatever. Video games. Slept on an opportunity because they slept through an MMO craze. They released, I think, a single player game. I can't remember. But then it actually lends itself just, well, expand on this world. I don't know, do something, right? But then, you know, like you wait for too long, no one's going to give a shit. But it is totally a lunchbox territory, and that someone failed to cash in on because, So someone needed to go and write these books, but he wanted to write these books himself, and he never wrote any because he says a lot and delivers little, and he takes a decade to make a movie anyway. Well, but I kind of feel go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna, maybe that's part of it too, is that Cameron is sort of lording over the property. It is like Avatar is a very special beast, not just because of the money it made, but it's an original IP. You know, that came out of someone's head as an original script, you know, in 2009. And that's unusual for a film.
So did Star Wars.
Yes. Yeah. But in the climate of the last 30 years, you know, or even the last 15 years in particular, what film that made $1 billion worldwide originated that way. But at any rate, going to the merchandising or the video games or anything else, Cameron could very well be, he and his company are lording over it, and No one wants to merchandise anything because we got to get Jim to approve it, and Jim's too busy, and Jim's like, it's probably doing written what? A contract somewhere.
Doing well, what?
You know, these movies and counting money, I guess. But yes. Anyway, like I'm speculating that anything connected to Avatar needs his approval. Like, doesn't the Pandora world, didn't that need a lot of supervision from Cameron's company and his overall approval? Like,
I suppose that's so. Disney, but it's totally, but it's totally merchandisable, because you can imagine, like, all these characters have names, have action. You can have action figures, stick them in a McDonald's, into Happy Meals. Bob's your uncle. Like, you're already there. Like, you're saturating the market. Just start with the 5-year-olds already, right? With Space Hunter, the movie that we're supposed to be talking about, and I just immediately derailed it to moan about James Cameron, because I really have a bone to pick with him. But this is more merchandisable, because you have characters that have names. They have distinguishable physical features. They're memorable, and they, you know. But the world kind of feels a little bit tactile. Sure, yes, it's, let's just say, a rehash of exactly what you've seen in Star Wars, because it's a Western in space, right? Because, you know, like, Peter Strauss is a gunslinger, you know, like, he rescues this woman, and there's some aggressive shampooing going on somewhere in there, right?
But sort of like The Searchers, right?
Sort of like this. Yes. It's a very delicate issue. But and then you have Michael Ironside being essentially Darth Vader, right? Mm-hmm. With claws. So it's already memorable.
As a Christmas tree ornament, sort of.
Dangling
there, yeah.
So I'm just thinking, okay, fine. It fits into the mold left after Star Wars. But equally, many of these movies are just, I think this is one of these examples, that many of these movies are just enjoyable to watch because, you know, kind of, like, they're familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of feel like that's kind of where the magic is, right?
Yeah. Here's a, just still on the merchandising thing, and we've had a few conversations revolve around it in the last month or so. I'm going to the whole Gizmo idea, where Spielberg would say, well, we need Gizmo to live because Gizmo is marketable and we could make, you know, plushies. That might be an element. That might be an element that Space Hunter doesn't have and all kinds of films don't have, is they don't, and but Star Wars does. You don't have the cute little character that can sort of get you through it. And Star Wars was always good for that, because if nothing else, you always had R2-D2 as just sort of an instant toy. Like, there's something to be said for the formula that Lucas came up with. And that's not really easily in here, but
we have his cars. You have the sort of the equipment, like we talked about the Ghostbusters with the Ecto-1 and whatever. And here you have the sort of the big like the snowplow.
Yeah.
That Ernie Hudson drives. There's the pirate ship on rails. There's Peter Strauss's scrambler. It's a very memorable sort of vehicles. I mean, maybe that's the allure.
Yeah. Yeah. But I guess, like, two, this had a $12 million budget or something. So it was never going to be going after the action figure crowd. And I guess, too, we sort of said that the action figure thing wasn't really a mature industry at this time either. Like, Star Wars had started doing it, but... Pretty much, no one else really had.
Here's a fun little question for you. Guess how much Return of the Jedi cost?
I'm going to say 40 million, 35, 40.
Well, you're kind of spot on, because, like, Wikipedia suggests between 32.5 and 42.5.
Oh, there you go.
Yay, so if you think it costs exactly twice, at least twice as much as this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this tells me, times, okay, well, this movie wasn't cheap to make either.
No, like, if it's, do we have the actual budget? What was it, 12, 14, something like that?
14 million, something like that, hold on.
14.4. But, you know, in the early 80s, in the early 80s, that's a considerable investment, which is why, too, I sort of pondered earlier in the conversation, say, well, I could see them not picking this up, right, too, right, because it is a gamble. And, you know, it turned out to be a gamble that didn't pay off. But I can see it being an okay gamble because it's a hot commodity. And, yeah, like, I think we get our budget's worth when you watch this, because there are some quite cool, impressive sets. You know, there's not too much space stuff. But the models here work really well. Like the spaceship is sort of cool. And then you've got, like you just alluded to, the scrambler and the snowplow and the bikes in this are really cool. And there's so many 80s things that are popular throughout the decade that I see here, like the use of motorcycles. And we've got this train, this pirate ship train is an impressive spectacle, and it's its own sort of playhouse fun ride. It's a fun set. The hang gliders are awesome. Like those, really impressive. Like that came right after. Absolutely. And that comes right after the abduction of these three castaways, these three women that they land on this planet, and they're sort of abducted immediately by these people that are basically behaving like Jawas. But that scene is really impressive as well, because there's characters coming from behind rocks and they're in silhouette, and it's this reddish sepia type of filter over everything, and the music is really effective there. There's some really impressive sequences. So there's money that's dumped into this for sure.
And yeah, and actually to good effect, because the opening set piece, like this movie kind of, after you know, like Peter Strauss ruins a computer and takes his female robot companion C-3PO, also being a woman, onto the planet, and they just come across these pirates. The set piece, I think it takes like 10 minutes all told, maybe 15 minutes, but it cooks. Like this whole, I really like this, and it just feels like my note was Return of the Jedi vibes much. And then I look up, this came out after that. And I'm pretty sure George Lucas wasn't really letting people know what he was up to, because he was quite secretive maybe about certain sequences, or maybe it was already out in the trailers and they just shot it on the cheap. Probably untrue, because they probably shot it a year earlier because it's still a studio film. So it looks the part. It looks, you know, my sort of little talking point I wrote for myself was, is it fair to compare this to Star Wars, or is it fair to compare it to Battle Beyond the Stars? Like, where does it sit? Is it the trashy knockoff, or is this something that really attempts to be a Me Too Star Wars? And then just wondering where you sit on this, because like for me, like special effects kind of look kosher enough that I would say it kind of elevates it above the sort of Roger Corman type schlock.
Yeah, I haven't seen Battle Beyond the Stars, but my sense here is that this is a legitimate effort. This isn't a, you know, straight to video B or C movie type of knockoff. This is, this has low hanging fruit type of aspirations in terms of what it wants to be, but it goes for it whole hog within the budget that it has. And it's not a small budget at $14 million in early 1980s. That's significant enough. Like it's, I would say, in terms of production value, it's trying to be a Mad Max type of film. Like that's where it's trying to lie in terms of its production value. It's staying away from too much of the stuff in space. And when they are in space at the very outset, some of the space effects are a little bit wonky. Just whatever that, remember those, was it the propulsion system? Some of that stuff looks a little bit wonky. They're not brave enough to show us inside that cruise ship, whatever that space shuttle is. We don't get any interiors there, because that would be just one other set. So we've got all this drama about this ship that is being destroyed. It's just given to us. And I think that's Harold Ramis' voice, right? Like the voiceover. Yep. And we hear, get to your escape pods. And
is that him? That's him. Okay,
I think so. I think so.
Because I couldn't be sure.
Anyway. Yeah, I wasn't 100% sure either. But I think he was the voice operator there, and that was sort of the one that stood out to me. So that's probably it, where he is. But they avoid, and I'd say, well, you know, let's put all our money on the planet. So we'll create this drama in space as quickly as we can, so we can get to the planet as quickly as we can, and all of our money is in that weird pirate ship, and in the we're going to build a whole lagoon in some warehouse somewhere, because that was sort of a weird set with the little
with these lake, Amazons
closed
these,
lake where the yeah the Amazons are, and so and, I think that's where all zombies. The money is. Yes, all the characters from Nothing But Trouble.
Yeah. It's in my notes, yes. Yeah. The twins from Nothing But Trouble are making an appearance in. So it kind of makes you think, just did Dan Aykroyd like raid the closet from this film? So, look at this suit. Can we use it? Yeah, sure, use it. Okay.
Yeah, maybe. Hey, Ivan, do you still have those? Do you still have those from your work on Space Hunter? I think yeah. I do, Dan. Can I borrow them?
Yeah. I mean, I could honestly believe that this is for reals. Like this costume has been reused for Nothing But Trouble. But then I'm just thinking to myself, like, what does this film lack that Star Wars has in terms of, okay, well, yeah, I suppose the fact it's not the first, so okay, fine. But like in terms of just production, right? I suppose the scale is missing, right? Because like Star Wars opens with this sort of, like, first thing you see is this massive sort of destroyer, right?
Yeah.
And then the detail on the model and whatever, and it's all epic, and it's already just in the middle of this battle, but you see the model and it's wow, it's amazing, right? And here the sort of the space part, it kind of feels like a 50s movie, kind of like I alluded to in the beginning. So you kind of really want to dispense with that as fast as possible, because we want to localize this. And I think they localize it as a Western. And I think the big gimmick of what they're trying to do is, okay, let's take the stars out of Star Wars and then just take the road out of Road Warrior and put it in there instead. So let's put Han Solo in Road Warrior, as opposed to let's put Luke Skywalker, as opposed to let's put Mad Max in Star Wars, if you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of, and that could very well have been the very precise genesis of this.
But does it work? Does it work for you, or
it does?
Because I mean, I know
it
was work for you in general because you liked it, but then it's just, is that something that you'd find appealing?
I'll revert to my young self. I would totally have loved this back in my youth, because the Han Solo character was a character that I loved, and I remember just being on jungle gyms and playground equipment, and I would run through and I'd be playing games in my head where, you know, I would have a blaster and I'd be shooting the guys behind me and I'd be muscling through the guys in front of me, you know, and I'm playing by myself, you know, friendless. but this is the adventure I'm having in my head. Exactly. Well, yes, that would be around the time, maybe.
Blasters, shurikens, all of it at the same time. The full caboodle.
But when I'm watching Space Hunter here, and Peter Krause says, okay, I'm going to go free these girls, and he runs onto this pirate ship, which is this, you know, train, which like 4 or 5 cars long. And what it is basically this gigantic amusement park where there's swinging bridges and ropes and little paths you have to jump across, and, you know, beams that you have to walk across, and there's villains and henchmen that you have to sort of punch through, and
in great costumes, mind you, as well.
Fantastic costumes. But I'm thinking to myself, this is exactly how I would play, you know, on a playground. And it has that type of energy, that type of fun. And, you know, it works really well. And going back to what you were saying, what is this missing? Scope is one thing that it's missing. It's got all the right things on the ground. I think that Overdog is a bit lacking in a way. I think that there's something that needs to...
As a villain
as a villain. There's something that that really... I think that this film would be improved if you have more moments with Overdog. I think what you do have is very brief moments with him. So, and again, maybe this is part of the scope. You don't have sort of a huge threat level with this villain. It's just... He's like the boss at the end of any old level in a video game. He's not the big boss at the end of the game. Like he's cool. But I don't really know what his story is here. I get a couple scenes and I know that he's horny and weird, and he sort of floats around like a weird Christmas ornament with these gangly claw hands.
Squid Game.
Yeah, play Squid Game. I think that's an element that could be used differently. The script is trying to get a lot of mileage out of this sort of main henchman, and he doesn't really work. So some of this stuff seems to be just following a formula, following a template, but the atmosphere and the tone and the depth to it isn't there the way that it is in Star Wars, say.
I mean, I totally agree. I mean, there isn't, if you look at it, not a single element in here is original. So here's essentially a template of Darth Vader, only kind of sort of shallow, because as you say, like he doesn't feel like the final boss. But then again, if you really want to be an apologist for this film, you could probably say maybe this is an element, this could function as an element of world building, because it makes you think like you could imagine that there is a bigger boss out there. And then kind of sort of in the same way as you could imagine with Darth Vader, because I suppose Darth Vader is a little bit more scary, but then again, like he's disposed of in a very sort of nonchalant way in Star Wars, right? So you could imagine, oh, especially that he also refers to Emperor this, Emperor that, there's Emperor that. So that means like he's just, there are people above him.
Yeah.
So he's a senior manager, but the C-suite, the CEO is above him, you know,
Space Hunter works as escapist, as just escapist fun fantasy, but there's an extra layer in Star Wars to the politics and the world building that's not here, and that does make the Star Wars franchise, even in those early days, something far more than its imitators were able to capture.
But within its own sort of, like, let's just say the shallowness of what it's trying to appeal to. Because it kind of tries to appeal to your base level expectations of what a fantasy in space would look like. And it kind of does that, right? There's no debate. It is successful in this. But then it's fun to be a part of this, especially when you actually imagine that certain things that it pulled out of its inspirations, i.e. Road Warrior, came after it, because it introduces the Thunderdome before Thunderdome was a thing, right? Because I think Thunderdome was like 1987. Was it?
Forget.
1985. There you go. So I'm just finding this fascinating, and especially that it kind of looks well made as well. Especially the score is made in a competent way, and it's very cool to listen to. I mean, but then again, Battle Beyond the Stars has a James Horner score, which is amazing. To me, it has all these elements that you could say in isolation, well, fair enough, this is a space western, this is all taken out of Star Wars, this is taken out of Mad Max, it all, all these ingredients are in place. So what's missing or is it just because it's, well, Star Wars was the original chocolate cake? Like, it's a good chocolate cake, but it's not the same. Like, it's, is that what it is?
Yeah, partly the Star Wars was the original, but I think too that it's the world building. In here, you don't have anything close to the Han and Leia and Luke dynamic, and that's sort of an interesting
piece. We kind of have Han and Leia, because Molly Ringwald is essentially your standard, like the Leia you can afford, right?
Yeah.
She's the Carrie Fisher you can get.
That's the attempt with that character, but she's a whiny brat, and
imagine if Kate Capshaw got Carrie Fisher's role. The whiny Leia. What are you doing, Han?
Tag along, yeah. And there's not really a romantic element too, because she's like 15, and they keep mentioning that. So it's almost like this adoptive parent type of potential relationship. So there's.
The Searchers, you mentioned it, right?
Yeah, there you go. So Han and Leia and Luke, so that dynamic isn't here. I think that the political world building is a whole other piece. And it probably means something to have a cute little character that sort of runs through this, like your C-3PO and your R2-D2, and that's not really here. There's sort of an edgy choice early on in this one, I find, because we've got this interesting dynamic with this really attractive, you know, fembot that is sort of the C-3PO here, that Chalmers has the name Chalmers, and mm-hmm. their first battle, she gets toasted and she sort of melts away, and it's a gross little scene, and it's a really, really good little scene. But that's an interesting choice, because I don't think Star Wars does that to it, because that's a character that I could see myself latching onto and saying, oh, this is sort of a neat dynamic, this fembot and
subversive.
Yeah. So anyway, this is just doesn't have the
it's a revisionist space western.
This doesn't have the legs or the depth to be what Star Wars is, but what it does do, it succeeds in most regards. And like I say, it's fairly simple aims. Let's be Star Wars. Let's be Road Warrior. Let's be Buck Rogers. Like,
mm-hmm. But see, let's be Star Wars. Let's be Road Warrior. Star Wars and Road Warrior ride on the character as well, right? How does Peter Strauss and Ernie Hudson and Molly Ringwald kind of fit into here? Do they actually attempt to do this? Or is, I think the only thing I read was that the producers really wanted to cash in on the Harrison Ford you can afford. Harrison mm-hmm. Ford. And it also kind of happens to come out after Temple of Doom. So I suppose there's this sort of the idea of also maybe just interlacing this with a little bit of Indiana Jones, because there are certain sort of the swashbuckling sort of element of that kind of comes through in there. But I kind of, yeah, I just wanted to kind of interrogate this just a little bit in terms of just characters. What do you think about, you know, Peter Strauss and Ernie Hudson and Molly Ringwald, especially in the context of, you know, what they're asked to do and how they're asked to act?
I think actually they work really well, mm-hmm. except for Ringwald. But I think
and Ironside as well.
And yeah, I think they're doing exactly what's asked of them. You know, it's sort of a copycat type of problem where we're asking you to be sort of the Harrison Ford type of character. And I think Krauss does a really good job. But, you know, it's... The film is really constructed set piece after set piece until we get to the end to save the girls. So one thing that is sort of overreaching through the whole film is the idea of saving these girls. That's a bit of a problem to me, because those girls are approximately meaningless, because they're given no real character. They're shot out of a ship and they land and they're abducted. We never really see them. So to me, they're non-entities. And I think that's something that Space Hunter really does miss, is I don't have any care or investment in these girls that are missing. And that's the big goal, is to get them out of the hands of get them out of the hands of Overdog. I'm not really too invested in that, because I don't know these girls. Not one of them has a personality. There's no way to differentiate any of them. They're just these castaways. And meanwhile, and even if we never saw them, Peter Krauss and Molly Ringwald and mm-hmm. Ernie Hudson, they seldom talk about the girls. Like, it's the film is moving along without too much discussion about the reason it's moving along. So the right. film does always sort of feel like it's just going through the motions.
Oh, I don't want to say I disagree, but I kind of disagree. Because for me, okay. these girls are a MacGuffin. That's all they are. They are just a device. Because it's not even the girls that are important. Because he doesn't go after them, like, we need to save these girls. It's a reward. He says, well, you get 3,000 mega credits.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm supposed to think, okay, I suppose mega credits is a lot of credits. Because I think it's 10 to the power of 6. It's 3,000 million credits. Okay. Just saying. It's quite a few. It's 3 billion credits. It's a few credits. So to me, this is all this is. Like, these women, these three castaways, apart from being whisked away with hang gliders, like, by absolute pros,
mm-hmm.
which is just the best scene. But they're essentially, I agree, they're meaningless, but they're meaningless on purpose, because they're only they're only there to make sure that you get Wolf. What's her name? Scaven. What's her
Nikki.
Name? Nikki. And Washington to kind of just move in the same direction. That's all this is for, because you need to kind of orchestrate the sort of you need to orchestrate two things. One thing is Nikki has to be in peril, and then everyone has to go into the big baddie's castle and defeat him. And then if you actually did this over these three women, then you'd have to introduce them first, so you kind of get to know them, and you'd have to probably just cut backwards and forwards to them, so you get some investment. But the only time you kind of cut to them is when the chemist goes like, "Well, we have new some fresh meat for you. Do they have all limbs? Because I like them when they have all limbs." Okay, it's a weird request. And then, so I would say that if he really wanted this, this movie would be 2.5 hours long and will be essentially Star Wars again, because then you get the chance to see what he does to kids, because there are these like mutant kids chanting with a beautifully haunting song.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But for no reason whatsoever. But then that's for me, this is just a MacGuffin. Like they need to get to the baddie's castle. They need to have a motivation to go there. And the motivation is to get the 3,000 mega credits.
And I hear that. I hear that. But I just feel as an audience member, I don't have any stakes in going there, so I'm not as invested in the journey. So it feels like I'm just simply going from set piece to set piece.
Oh, because I felt kind of different, because I felt like I'm not invested in the journey, as in like I'm not invested in why they're going there. I'm invested in the fact that they're just, I get to hang out with them, right? And they're just like, and they're just traveling in this direction, and stuff happens to them, and then as stuff happens to them, they get more and more inclined to actually go and pursue this goal, because eventually just Nikki gets whisked away, right? Mm.
And I guess this is the layer maybe between this film and Star Wars, is this film is happening to these characters, whereas, you know, Luke in Star Wars is, he's the chosen one, and, you know, this story follows.
The film is happening to Luke.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and so it's just a degree of separation thing. I don't disagree with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose you're totally correct. It's just for me, I don't necessarily mind jumping from set piece to set piece, because I have motivations to do so. It's not like I'm not watching a Michael Bay film where it's like I'm essentially just being exposed to a tech demo, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't care about these characters whatsoever. I do care about Peter Strauss, and I care about Ernie Hudson. I care that they have some kind of shared history as well, however poorly fleshed out it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I have an excuse to watch them interact with the world that they are in, and then because I want to have the excuse to see them use these practical effects, and I want to have an opportunity to see Michael Ironside firing fireballs at them, which they looked real.
So, there's a few good pyrotechnic moments too. One in particular is where, also in the end, Peter Krause, he's in disguise and he just sort of drops a bomb and walks away. And then that there's this pyrotechnic, this explosion that seems to go off right between these two mm-hmm. actors. There's some good sequences there in the end. It's sort of fun.
Actually, when we're at the end, this whole, I want to say the last 20, 25 minutes is this massive sort of set piece built around this humongous set with, I suppose this is where Dan Aykroyd probably just picked a few scenes in there. But it literally is a bit of a sort of like a stand-in for, or like a protoplast for the Thunderdome, or for like the Running Man or something like that, right?
Yeah, an American Ninja.
An American Ninja, but
like the game show. What's that called? I think that's called
Takeshi's Castle, or
yes. Is this? Yeah.
Yeah, only for reals, right? But then it's kind of... Yeah, for those who don't know, it is essentially Michael Ironside. It's essentially Darth Vader who organizes his own Squid Game, right? So just, people just dropped in there, just like, survive. And there are just chainsaws everywhere and buzz saws, whatever, and fire. But yeah, for me, the whole set piece is a masterful sort of production. I don't know, what did you feel about this, of the last 20 minutes, especially when this is when you get to interact with Overdog McNabb a little bit more. It's a great name, by the way.
It is.
He's not an underdog, he's an overdog.
Overdog McNabb. It feels a little bit like my memory. It's been a long time since I've seen The Wizard of Oz, but when the main characters infiltrate the witch's castle and they do so in disguise and they sneak into this, what ultimately is this big warehouse type of set. It's that type of vibe in a way. But when they break in there, there really is an ingenuity that's going on with the set design. And you can sort of tell if you look at it that it's not as big a space as they make you feel that it is. It looks like it might be in a huge warehouse or something, but I wonder if it's just in, you know, a two-story garage, two-car garage. Like it's because there's a lot of the camera is behind, you know, junk piles, and it, you know, if you look closely, where Overdog is hanging, he's actually really close to this pit area where characters are dropped, and a little car comes out with, you know, a spiky wheel that's going to run over it. So everything is in a fairly condensed space, sort of like a McDonald's Playland. It's just a very small amount of real estate that they're doing all this, and they do a good job with it. And there's some unique stuff that seemed like there was a funnel with people stacked in the funnel. And just the person at the bottom would be the one that would be released. I thought that was sort of an interesting concept. But, you know, it looks good. It's fun. It does have that 1980s funhouse danger type of thing. Like we've talked about the, you know, the underground fun amusement parks, the sewer slides, and this
Texas Chainsaw Massacre too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Judgment Night. And we've got slides and chutes in this as well. Yeah. So, you know, and to me, like I think about playing as a kid in the 80s, and it was outside and you're running through parks and you're running through obstacles. And this is a very tactile type of, feeling that I get from this movie, is that this is an adventure that I could be on. Right. So it plays into a kid's imagination, quite well. You know, so I had fun with this, and I think they're doing a lot with a really small amount of space, to be honest.
Oh yeah, and there's one element of this, of the big castle design, that really stuck out to me as a very memorable. There's this sort of, when the chemist goes like, "Red Sea over Doug McNabb," and I'm just wondering, is this Colin Mochrie? Because there's Colin Mochrie's in this film, and it's his debut, and I'm not sure where he is.
Yes, I think he's the guard. He's one. There were two guards at one point that grab Molly Ringwald.
Oh,
I think,
that's him.
I think he's one of them. I like Colin. Are you familiar with Colin Mochrie?
I mean, when I was like, I want to say mid-20s, so a long while ago, I was very much into Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
So
that's him.
So
he's in here.
Cool. I was very much into Colin Mochrie, Rand Stiles.
Yeah.
All those guys. Oh, these guys were cool. So that's how I know Colin Mochrie.
Yeah.
But yeah, what I want to say is there's this element of set design. I'm not sure what this is. Is this like a tunnel where they use lasers? There's this green and orange lasers everywhere to kind of just, I want to say, mystify a little bit of what you're actually looking at. And I think there's this tunnel that leads to Overdog McNabb. So you don't quite know where he's standing, whether he's hovering over something or what was going on. But you see only like the top half of him, and he's kind of just somewhere just suspended in God knows where, because he's covered in this sort of awash with light. He is, right?
And there's equipment and mirrors, not mirrors, but like windows or something in front of him too. It seems like there's panes of glass, and like he's shield it. It's if they said we can get more production value or make this look a little bit more impressive.
He's in a tractor
bigger
cabin.
Yeah. if there's some bunch of things in front of them. But yeah, there's that corridor, this round corridor with the lights. That's sort of a cool looking thing. I think it's done very simply. Like I think that it would be very easy to make a sort of a fun house and get that effect going if you just put some lights on some hula hoops and synchronize the lights. But it is impactful, and it's memorable, and it sort of works nicely, and it doesn't look cheesy. I think if you could really see how that was created, it would be underwhelming, but it comes off quite well. I suspect it's quite a cheesy little setup, but I think that it certainly comes off, you know, impactful and sort of works for what it's doing.
And it kind of shows you how much you can accomplish by just hiding stuff in shadows a little bit more.
Agree.
And then lighting does quite a lot. Yep. But then, like, one thing we haven't mentioned is just the character of Overdog. Like, you don't know anything about him anyway. He's just this sort of big guy in black. And then the way he looks, he's like Darth Vader without his helmet, kind of crossed a little bit with Nosferatu.
And a pervert.
And for some reason, he's all into these, like, there's a whole sort of conversation we could have on the sexual politics of this film and how this is, I think the word for today standards is problematic, right?
I would agree totally with that statement.
There are a few scenes in there where you think to yourself, if you show this to today's audiences, to someone who's like 19 or 20, and then they would have someone canceled over this. And nothing really happens in there. There's this sort of an implication, like there's an inference of something happening, but nothing really gets shown. Like there's,
yeah, well, nothing's really shown, but Overdog at one point, like he asks his right hand man, okay, well, do you have some new girls? Yes, they're young and they're from Earth and they're smooth skin. So the fact that he seems to be just looking for young girls, that's because he mentions that again with Ringwald. Oh, you're young. And then there's the other bit where the girls are brought to him. Oh, undress her for me. And like there's a perviness to this character, which is weird. And it wouldn't fly today. You know, unless there's a commentary that went with it. If it was for a purpose.
There is a commentary already, and it's just, this is something that, you know, it's an essay waiting to happen. Like Overdog McNabb is Harvey Weinstein, just saying.
Yeah. Like this is caked into the era. No one would have batted an eye to this.
He's a big shot producer, just taking young, supple actresses through the meat grinder of Hollywood, and then just figuratively and literally, and they're just ruining their lives.
There you go. Yeah.
There you go. That's your essay.
40 word essay right there.
There you go. It's a haiku.
Yeah. Yeah. that's true. But that's just, you know, that's a function of it being in the 80s and people not knowing any better, or, you know, it just is what it is.
I think they knew better. They just choose not to, right? Like I bet you money people in the 80s weren't going like, so you can't do this? What do you mean?
But I think that's normalized behavior on screen, right? Like, and I think you've got a history of that. If you know, just throughout film, especially definitely in North America, I'll say, you've got this, you know, women belong to men mentality. Like, you know, watch a Hitchcock film from the 50s and the leading man is always grabbing the woman by the arm and, you know, walk this way. And I see that it's
watch a Bond movie thing. From the 80s, same thing.
Totally the same thing. So as this translates into, you know, film and theater and TV, it is what it was. So, you know, I think, do they know any better? If they really stop to think, they might, might say otherwise. But, you know, I think when it's time to shoot, no, we have to exit. So grab her by the elbow. Oh, this guy's really nasty. So, you know, get the young girls in there and, you know, undress her. You know, it's just no one bats an eye.
I think they have the foresight at least to actually have, I think, maybe I'm wrong, only the villain do this sort of creepy shit. I think that's the only time you kind of see it. I mean, okay, well, apart from the aggressive shampooing scene, where I think Peter Strauss is really just get in there and just wash yourself. I'll show you how to do it. It's just like he's not being Harrison Ford. He's just being John Wayne for a second.
Yeah, he's just being a bully. He's
just bullying this woman into washing herself. Okay, now just full on immersion. Go again. I'm just really, this is this is going into dark places.
It does stand out as weird, right? It's, but you know, it's not right, but it's, you know, the
What if she stunk? Well, you know.
She stunk, and, you know, the man was the boss. You know, it just is what it is.
He just happened to have a travel bottle of shampoo on him. Jesus Christ, what a ridiculous scene.
There's a perfect sized puddle there to bathe in, too. Everything just worked out.
Yeah, but they do, after this, they kind of have to sort of, this is kind of like a bonding ritual for them, because they become like buddies after this. Because before that, it's kind of less, just, she's almost, like, Molly Ringwald is kind of, because we really didn't touch much on her, but she's almost like a nuisance, and then eventually she becomes this sidekick, right? And then she becomes a damsel in distress again. Like, I suppose this is, well, this is the 80s. Like, now, you know, she's not a Mary Sue or anything like that. She's a, you know, she's an 80s female sidekick. So with everything that goes with it. But I suppose you kind of have to take it as a product of its time. And it is what it is. And it just so happens that Molly Ringwald is just insanely entertaining to me. Just as a person.
Not for me in this film. Like, almost every moment she just
really
almost throughout she just sort of grates my nerves. Just that
three
type
times
of,
she was just going through these Kate Capshaw moments, but anyway,
yeah, for me it was just incessant throughout. She just didn't land with me. I don't necessarily see the charm in this, but too, like, this is at the start of the 80s, and you get a lot of this type of humor, you know, the odd couple and, you know, young, old, one's mature, one's nuts, one won't shut up. Like, the chatty Cathy type of character is just, you know, that's just something you get a whole ton of. And I don't think that Molly Ringwald is seasoned enough a performer here to make that work. Like, she can't be Billy Crystal in Running Scared, who is he's a motor mouth in that, but he's perfectly, you know, charming, and he's on point, and I, like, Molly Ringwald just is whiny, and, you know, it's as if you have the worst of Kevin McAllister hanging out with you for the whole film.
Well, by the way, fun. I'm not sure how fun this is. We just wrapped our recording of Shadows, and then. This is her second film. Her first was Tempest, which was also one of the last performances by John Cassavetes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
After that, I think he only did, like, what, 2-3 films? Because it's early 80s, so 82, 81, and then he died in 1989. But I think he finished acting, like, 85.
Okay.
He wasn't in the best shape, I suppose, but yeah.
Yeah, because she's Molly Ringwald, back to her, she's incredibly young here. She is only 15 or something, isn't she? So, like, me being hard on her, you know, in a way, may not be fair.
Poor choice of words.
No one would have caught that.
This is why I'm here.
There you go.
I think she was born in 1968. Jeez Louise, she was very, very young.
She was probably then, like, late 15 when she shot it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like, she's a young performer at this time, and, you know, she's following the beats that she's given. And I guess there's probably the reason she became a star after this, she probably showed a certain level of maturity on set here, like, in terms of, you know, knowing that her lines were duds and, you know, being able to stick up for herself and say, can we rework some of these lines? And, you know, she certainly has a presence. So I can see how she becomes a thing after this, but just her performance here just sort of, it's like nails on a chalkboard.
I mean, just, like, stuff she says sometimes, well, like, it's all brain works to me. It's just, she's like, oh, I can't remember how she uses a word, because the only thing I wrote down maudlin. Was melonium or something,
or
like that.
Or is it maudlin?
I can't remember now, but just, okay. Like, she uses these, like, made up words as well. It's just, I don't know. I find her fascinating. She's just, I don't know. She has this presence about her. I don't know. I like her.
Yeah, she has a presence, and I sort of like I like the writing of the character, or the rewriting of the character, you know, that she's like, oh, I have a brother and I have a father and they have weapons and they'll get you. And, you know, I'm a tracker and, you know, my mom's a medic. And so I sort of like that. I like what she's saying, you know, and I get the effort that they're, you know, they're trying to, you know, connect them. But it's just, it's not really working for me, because you've got this weird moment too where they're going to cuddle. There's this thing with her arm around him and it turns into sort of this awkward cuddle session, and at the end she just wants to be asked to go with him, and I don't know, none of that really lands
because they're buddies now.
But yeah, it's just, she was too annoying to care. Like, it just it doesn't work.
Yeah, so I don't know. I feel like I'm running out of notes as well. Not sure. But I don't know. I kind of find this movie a little bit more fascinating than I originally would have given it credit for.
Yeah.
Like, it's, yeah.
Absolutely. What were your thoughts on Peter Krause? Oh, Peter, I like the guy.
Peter Strauss?
Strauss, yeah.
My note is, he's Harrison Ford meets Christopher Lambert meets Peter Fonda. Just
I had Harrison Ford meets Gabriel Byrne, actually.
Gabriel Byrne, that's a shout, actually, yeah. But Peter Strauss is kind of like an interesting one, because he's a face that you kind of recognize, but you don't know where from. Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking at this filmography, I'm just like, not sure if I have seen him in anything.
Same.
He's a lot of television bits, but he looks familiar. He looks like he has this sort of like Harrison Ford, sort of like this sort of rogue everyman sort of energy about him. And I really like the way he kind of carries himself, because he's almost like this reluctant hero as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think I suppose it's a good counterpart for someone like Han Solo, because I think they ask him to be Han Solo, but he doesn't feel like he has the balls to be one. So he kind of looks like exactly like that. He looks like this sort of the gunslinger who doesn't have the balls to be the gunslinger that he actually needs to become at the end to save the lady, you know? So it kind of gives him depth almost, that he's kind of sort of a little bit unassured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked him, and I like you, like, I looked at his filmography and I was like, I don't know if I've seen him in any of these things, but you know, he was a working actor and fairly accomplished in TV in the 70s and 80s, I'm going to say. But I don't know if I recognize him from anywhere. But I think he has a tremendous amount of presence. I think that he's engaging and funny when he needs to. And the whole 80s idea of dropping one-liners, like, he was on top of a few sort of funny one-liners. There was a nice little one-liner he has whenever the Amazons say, oh, a breeding male. Oh, we can't. He wouldn't be able to breed with us. He's not man enough to breed with us. I'd like to take that bet, or something like that. Like, he's dropping these little one-liners. Like, he does everything asked of him, and I think he's a great counter to Ernie Hudson. And I really liked him, and I'm sort of surprised that he didn't really surface other places, recognizable places. And I'm just wondering to myself if there's a story with that. Like, because I think that he could have handled more starring roles or interesting supporting roles in bigger projects, but never really seemed to.
Well, he didn't. I don't know. I'm not gonna say anything. Yeah, I suppose at some point you have to make choices. I don't know, and say, like, I'm not prepared to do that for a role. So it's just. But then, weirdly enough, what do you think about Ernie Hudson? Because I think this is kind of the last question I have for you. Because this is pre Ghostbusters, by the way.
Yeah, and I actually looked at Ernie Hudson's filmography, and I didn't realize how prolific he was in the 70s. Like, he was a working actor for a long time before Ghostbusters made him a big star. And interestingly, my suspicion is this film introduced him to Ivan Reitman, and then when they were casting for Ghostbusters, it's like, oh, we should see if Ernie's available. He'd be a good fit here. You know, I'm just speculating again.
So, but without this movie, there's no Ghostbusters. Just
there
saying.
You go. Maybe not. But Ernie Hudson, I think he's great. He looks really, really fit in here. And I think that he's got, you know,
when
a strong presence.
Yeah.
I don't remember him ever being really this fit. Like, he just, he seems, I don't know.
He's buff, yeah.
He's a big guy. And then if you look back through, like, different pictures of his supporting roles and, like, things like The Dukes of Hazzard and whatever else he was in the 70s, like, he was in all of those shows in the 70s and 80s. Like, he was just a prolific guy. But he was sort of a big, strong, buff guy. And I think he has a lot of presence. And, you know, we said it last month talking about Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2 and Leviathan and also Twin Peaks The Return. He's just great. And he was here too. I thought he was great.
And it's not the end, by the way, because there's going to be at least one film that we're going to touch on later in the year where he's in.
What's the next one?
Oh, I don't know what I do. Should I spoil it?
No, okay. Yeah, no. Tell me later because I forget.
I'll tell you later. So okay. You guys will figure it out later on. But there's another Ernie Hudson film that we're going to be doing.
Yeah, we're big Ernie Hudson fans here.
So, you know, I really like him.
Yeah, I do too. And, like, he does have the ability to just, it feels like he's just one of those guys that has a quick chemistry with whoever he's working with, and just a consummate professional. I get the idea. He shows up and can do pretty much anything. Like, yeah. It's very cool.
I suppose, yeah, as a whole, it's a sum of its parts experience, because everything you kind of point to works. It just doesn't add up to anything they kind of transverses above and beyond the sort of the remits of the sort of the fantasy space western, right? It's kind of just what it is. So I don't know. Well, yeah, let's just, I feel like this is, it's a good point to kind of just bring this to a close, unless there's something you really want to get off your chest.
No, that's a bit about it for me.
So, too. You know, final take on Space Hunter : Adventures in the Forbidden Zone.
Yeah, I'll keep this simple. Like, I think the aim wasn't that high here. The aim was to create a, you know, a space drama with a bit of a swashbuckling feel. Let's emulate Star Wars, Buck Rogers, and Road Warrior. And this film does it. And I don't want to say perfectly, because it's not a perfect film, but it does a really solid job. And it's just really a fun adventure. And it did make me think of when I was a kid running through playground equipment and imagining, you know, henchmen chasing me in this sort of weird fantastical world. It has that energy. It's got the funhouse type of sets, and it was just sort of a fun film straight through.
Yeah. Makes you wonder what it would have been like in 3D, by the way. Just one last thing.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder if it's a lot of the space stuff that was that was targeted towards. Like, I had the impression that ship that explodes at the beginning, that was meant for 3D. And
then the rest is in 2D.
And the rest is in 2D. Yeah, I don't know. The hang gliders might have had a bit of an impact on me. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like
some of these sort of, like, in the funhouse sequence, you have these buzz saws coming out. I think they would have been sticking out of the screen a little bit.
And that round corridor of pulsing light, that probably would have. Yeah.
The sort of the Mad Max type sort of car that they use in the maze to chase these people, they kind of always kind of comes at the camera. And the hands come, because they sleep in the sort of watchtower somewhere, and there's fat zombies from Nothing But Trouble coming at them. I suppose they will be somewhere in there as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, I feel kind of similar too. It's kind of, it is what it is. It fits in the mold of the sort of the post Star Wars fantasy western exactly, and does what it needs to do. It provides, I don't want to say base level entertainment, but just entertainment just as a whole. It doesn't have anything else to say or do. It doesn't elevate on its world building, even though I think it kind of hints at some. So some nerds would have probably be able to kind of just write a novel, or at least a novella somewhere set in this world, and they would be probably, and someone would probably be happy to read it. And overall, I just find immense enjoyment from watching people interacting with physical sets, with these sort of modified trucks, and these sort of pirate ships on rails, these mazes and the costumes. All of this kind of adds up to something that you just feel, I just feel immense respect towards. Because it's not on green screen. It's not zeros and ones. It's someone put these costumes together. Someone actually sat down and then modified a military sort of vehicle to look like a space scrambler, right? Or someone just took this snowplow and made it look like it's a sort of rusted sort of post-apocalyptic sort of vehicle. I always kind of feel like hats off, you know, and yep. things like that I get to watch. So, and then and this kind of just rides straight down the middle between Star Wars and Road Warrior, and then in doing so also kind of sets a few things for Beyond Thunderdome, but you know, and for other things to follow. So that's it. I really like it, and I'm really happy to have watched it. So, top three moments, how about that? Let's go do that.
Yeah, let's do. Okay, so just a shout out to it's this film has a surprisingly keen sense of humor. Like if you there's some nice little lines in there. Just Ernie Hudson at one point says, "Blast them now. We'll get to know them later." Like there's That's just these little little throwaways. There's a bunch of them in there. So it's not a film that you'd necessarily would think would have top-notch costumes, top-notch production design, you know, a sense of humor, a cagey sense of humor built in. But it does, like it's sort of top-notch in some of these areas. So just sort of a quick shout out to that. But in terms of my top three, there's a scene in there where there's a number of creepy kids. They're the main characters are in a canyon, and these creepy kids, and they all look like Sloth from Goonies. They're sort of around the canyon, looking down on them, and they start throwing Molotov cocktails at them. That's just sort of a really creepy scene. You know, it just sort of impacted me in that way. It's like, this is really off in all the best possible way. Like the music ties into it, and yeah, that was cool. Number two, the death of the Fembot Chalmers. Like this is a really weird moment. It's a very specific choice that we're not spending the whole movie or a larger chunk of the movie with this idea of this Fembot. She was sort of an interesting character and sort of interestingly played by the actress. But the death itself involves this melting, like the face melts whenever Wolf, he hits like an auto-destruct button and on a remote, and she just sort of melts and sort of fades away, and it's really well done, really nice practical effect. And the movie has a certain oomph that it's sort of willing to do that so early, mm-hmm. and it looks serious, so I like that. But number one, that the stunt with the hang gliding girls is just fantastic. Like in the script, they're called vultures, but they swoop down and they grab these girls and they just keep on flying, and it's just really seamless and looks really slick. And yeah, and it's just, again, early in the movie, and this is the type of thing I'm seeing, and the vultures really impressed me.
Awesome.
Okay.
Okay. I've got one honorable mention. I promised myself I wouldn't do that, but I kind of have to. So, Michael Ironside's fireballs, just as a mention, because he shoots them at people, and just you can see it's like something's really on fire in there. So, you know, I really like that. So yeah. Number three, the green / orange tunnel, that visual.
Yeah.
Really love it. I mean, just an element of sitting. It's all dark in there. It's just such a great looking sort of piece of production design. Again, the echo chamber alert, the hang glider swiping this woman off the ground like a bird of prey. What a stunt.
Yeah. Times three.
What a stunt. Times three. Great. Yes. It's amazing. It's just this whole idea is amazing. And then number one, the pirate ship attack sequence. Just this whole, like, this is how we start this movie. Just with this sort of big attack sequence. And also there's this thing in there, I think you might notice, as the rope bridge trick, when he has this sort of, Peter Strauss has this sort of henchman in front of him, and just stomps on the rope bridge and the guy falls. Mm-hmm. That's just interesting. Yeah, so that's my tops. Bottoms?
Cool. Okay, so for bottoms, What have I got here? All right. Molly Ringwald. Why do they call them hot dogs?
This is Battle Beyond the Stars territory, because they do talk about hot dogs in there.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's a reference.
I feel like this is a wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Maybe. But anyway, I just thought that was sort of a...
It's not good, is it?
Stupid conversation. And I get, like, it's character work and stuff, and it's connection and quirk, but yuck. Yeah. The whole Molly Ringwald take a bath scene, like, it's...
the aggressive shampooing.
It involves weird bullying, and on top of that, Molly Ringwald is annoying and fussy at the start, and then
and
at
underaged.
Playing closer to her age at the end of the scene, she's pouting like she's a 3-year-old when it's all said and done. And I think there's a layer of comedy that's supposed to sort of wash over me there, but the whole thing is just sort of, you know, clumsy just as a comedic conceit. And I mentioned this one earlier, my top, the three castaways, they have no agency, no personality, no character. Yeah, I think that's a fair point to say, well, you know, they're just sort of a MacGuffin and a mulligan that we don't have to worry about. They're just sort of a cause to go. Fine. I think, though, that if I knew more about this ship at the beginning, if I knew more about these characters in some way, it adds to the world building, and I'm just a little bit more invested in it. Like, to me, like, this is sort of representative of the layer between this and Star Wars.
I think you'd have to add quite a bit more, because if you just add of the ship, it would be just, look, this is the MacGuffin we saw on the ship earlier.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I'll say the aggressive shampooing scene just about missed my list, because I think this is a bit too serious. I might as well leave it out. I mentioned this in conversations that I'm happy that I did. So I decided to kind of just go a little bit more lighthearted over this. So... we've got 4 again, so, well, actually I have 5, but I don't really want, okay, fine, I'll mention both of them.
Do it,
so
do it.
So two honorable mentions. One is just when Molly Ringwald jumps into the water in the Amazon sort of lair, the shots reverse. Like, it's reverse.
Okay.
She gets grabbed from underneath and then just dragged underwater, but I think the shot was when she was emerging.
Okay.
It's just so weird. And okay, another dishonorable mention is when Michael Ironside just has this big reveal, just because he says, if you do go through this maze, you're gonna go free. And then he goes, I lied. No one goes free. I'm just, wow, this is the just straddling very close to the sort of Joel Schumacher, Batman and Robin, Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze. Chill. And he goes, what killed the dinosaurs? The Ice Age. Allow me to break the ice. Where was I? And yeah, so bottom 3. Oh, and there's also this random chicken in the pirate ship, by the way. Did you notice? There's
yes.
A chicken.
Yeah.
which I didn't know what to do with it, because it belongs on both the bottom and the top list, if you really think about it. So, number 3. They say it a few times. It's like, oh, can you use your spectrometer? Spectrometer this. I think they mean spectrometer. I don't know what a spectrometer is, unless it measures spectrums. I don't
know. Sounds dirty. Stick that up your spectrum.
Just not gonna say anything. New year, new me. No, I'm not doing it. Not gonna bite. It's like trying not to fart. It's all...
You're so well behaved. Goodness.
Okay, number 2. Number 2. Okay. Molly Ringwald finds out her father is dead. He's like, oh, they're all dead. And she says, oh. Stop the line. Oh. It's just, oh, that's going to ruin my day. Like, really? And the weirdest thing in the... I tweeted this today. Is I call it the carrot in the blaster. When Peter Strauss is in the claws of Michael Ironsides, you can see the top of his blaster. And it's either a hot dog or a carrot sticking out of it. And I don't know what what it is. I don't know if you've seen this.
No, I didn't notice. I didn't see your tweet.
It's on my Twitter account, at TalkAboutFilm on Twitter is where you can find that kind of crap. Did you see it?
No, pursuing it now. Just a sec.
Or is this a cigar? I'm not sure. Like this.
What? So bizarre.
What is it?
Yeah.
So Space Hunter can be found, I think, on your streaming services where you can buy or rent stuff. I don't think it streams anywhere. Oh, no, hold on. In the US, you can find it on Tubi. But I think I checked in Canada, it's just rent or buy. And in the in the UK, it's also just Apple TV or Google or YouTube where you can actually buy or rent it. So you can't you can find it if you want. And I actually would say go and find it. Go and watch
Do it.
Give this movie a life that it deserves. So I think with that, I think we can close the proceedings. The court will adjourn. So where can we find you on social media and stuff?
All right. So long as Twitter is still kicking, I am at Randy Burrows there. On Letterboxd, you can find me at Bratch7. And once in a while, hopefully in the next few weeks, I get back into writing again. And if I do, you'll find me on clapperltd.co.uk.
Boom. And also, you can find me at TalkAboutFilm on Twitter. I'm still, until Twitter kind of closes doors, I think I'll be there just posting crap. Jakob Flash Letterboxd, flashonfilm.com, clapperltd.co.uk as well. And then follow the show at Uncut Gems Pod everywhere. And also check out our website, www.uncutgemspodcast.com, where you can just go and browse through our back catalog of everything that we have. And you will find that on top of this main show, there's also a whole Patreon account that we run with bonus podcasts. And I think at this point, there's probably 40 podcasts to listen to. So there's quite a lot of stuff to dig into. And these are all sort of bonus tie-ins with classics that we talk about. The full-on David Lynch marathon. And then this year, Soderbergh project. John Cassavetes is dropping next week. A whole lot of stuff, and it's only $3 a month to sign up and support us with just your, you know, like a coffee's worth of cash, a coffee cup's worth of money, and then you'll get access to all that, and then you'll also get our endless appreciation as well. And also if you don't feel like spending that kind of money every month, you can also buy us a coffee at coffee.com/uncutgemspod. And if you don't feel like doing so either, I totally understand. We get it. You can also leave us a review, leave us a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And then you can also feel free to get in touch. uncutgemspod@gmail.com. Just send us an email. Tell us what you think about this movie and tell us about anything. Just, you know, go and vent within reason. And that's it, I suppose. Stay tuned until next week, because then we'll be finishing our little Space Westerns mini marathon by talking about Space Rage. So also a big sort of unknown for me. I think for you too, right? Have you not seen this?
Have not seen it.
Don't know what it's going to be about, but we picked it out of a lineup of Space Westerns from the 80s and we're sticking with it. So just stay tuned for that.
And it's got Alvin Strait in it.
There you go. It has Richard Farnsworth. So it's gonna be great. So stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, you know, just take care.